You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin author about his experience in Iraq and Afghanistan and his new novel about the difficult return to civilian life.
First, more than half of Wisconsin adolescents said their mental health was not good at some point in a one-month period. 1 in 10 had considered suicide, and most of the young people in the state experiencing depression don't get treatment, according to recent data.
Today is Children's Mental Health Awareness Day, and USA Today Network Wisconsin hosted an event in Madison to raise awareness about the mental health challenges facing youth in Wisconsin. The event is called the Day of Action on Youth Mental Health. It's the culmination of 9 months of reporting for the Kids in Crisis series, which focused on mental health in Wisconsin's youth.
We have two guests with us to talk about the issue. Jim Fitzhenry is an editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, who oversaw the Kids in Crisis series. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
And Chris Saha also joins us. She spoke at the event today. She's a former psychiatric nurse who lost her teen daughter to suicide. Chris, thanks for coming up.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, Jim, tell us about this Day of Action for Youth Mental Health. Why did you convene this event?
Really, we wanted to take everything that we had learned in this series called Kids in Crisis and actually have something constructive happen from it. When you go out in Wisconsin and you collect the data and you tell the stories, and you hear from families of people like Chris, you want to take that and you want to turn that conversation into action that can actually make things better for families across the state.
And who was at the table today?
We had a really wide variety of people from the healthcare industry, lawmakers, families. We had a really great cross-section of the state there talking about this issue. And the great thing that we learned along the way is that people are really eager to have these conversations, that once you start to break down the stigma, people want to talk about it, they want to share their stories, and they want to share ideas about how we make things better.
And Chris, you shared your story at the event. Can you tell us how suicide touched your family?
Yes, I lost my daughter, Morgan. She was 15 years old, and that happened last June. She took her own life while she was here in Wisconsin visiting her dad and some friends. I was living in Florida at the time.
And I think a lot of times, historically, maybe even recently, this is a story that a family doesn't want to talk about, that gets kept in private. Why is it important for you to share the story at events like today's?
I would like to help in any way that I can. I would like to help parents or basically anybody that's involved with adolescents to maybe pay closer attention to things they may see, behaviors, things like that. And then I think the piece, being a psychiatric nurse in the past, certainly I see two different perspectives on the issue, and I see what a huge crisis it really is.
And as I understand it, your daughter had posted about her thoughts of having suicide on social media. Other youth saw it and just didn't know what to do. Is that important to get a message out? If you see something, say something.
Extremely important. And yes, I think I did speak with a few of her friends who were some of the people who liked the photos, and they said that social media, these sites are actually just outlets for teens to express their feelings, and you know, then they feel less alone. They feel that other kids maybe are struggling too, but instead of taking some action when they see things like that or hear them talking, they just keep it to themselves and try to support one another.
And Jim, is that part of what's coming out on the solution side, is making people, peers, parents, practitioners, know what to do when they hear that message?
Absolutely. And the extraordinary thing is that we met Chris at our Wisconsin Rapids town hall meeting. She came up and asked if she could speak about her daughter. And just in the little bit of time that I've got to know her, she's been able to give people so much great information from her experience that is going to help other people who hear that and understand, yeah, if I hear something, I should let somebody know. Just that real simple connection, that real simple piece of information can make a profound difference.
Chris, can you share some of those thoughts for maybe parents or even teens listening right now who they're going through something highly personal, but you've learned lessons that apply to a lot of people?
I guess when I think about things I would do differently, I definitely wouldn't dismiss anything I see that I would maybe consider abnormal or even normal teen behavior. If your kids are isolating themselves, as Morgan did, I would talk to other parents and they'd say, well, so is my child. But in reality, you know, that was now looking back, that was a red flag. Keep these kids talking, I think, is hugely important.
We're talking about youth mental health here in Wisconsin. Chris Saha is with us, former psychiatric nurse. She lost her teen daughter to suicide last year. She's made it her mission to help other teens, help their parents work through these issues. We also have Jim Fitzhenry with USA Today Network Wisconsin. Been reporting in the Kids in Crisis series, had a day of action on youth mental health today. Jim, what other kind of policy recommendations are coming out now to try to make sure teens have access to mental health care when they need it?
One of the things that we talked about today that Chris was able to share her experience is that in schools, to get screenings for children at much younger ages, we had a social worker from Stevens Point who talked today about some of the issues that they're dealing with in their schools. And I think it was very eye-opening for a lot of people that really severe problems are presenting themselves as students as young as kindergarten. And so when Chris comes in with a message that says we need to screen kids at younger ages, I think that's a sort of direct experience that can help policymakers see, yeah, we definitely need to do this, think about it, get kids talking about it in families at a much younger age.
So catching the problem earlier, and Chris, you've been a psychiatric nurse too. Once that problem is caught, do we have accessible care, levels of care that people can find?
Unfortunately, not in the state of Wisconsin. And I don't know if it's a nationwide issue or not, but I know there are not enough providers in Wisconsin. So that is one additional obstacle to care.
You had a couple of state lawmakers, I believe, at the event. Jim, do you see people in charge of state government taking these issues seriously, wanting to do something maybe in the next session?
You know, I get the sense that the lawmakers that we had today were very receptive to listen to it. And I think that they also encourage people in the audience to contact their lawmakers, to contact the governor as he and his administration are putting together a new budget to start to look at these issues and to look at innovative ways to start to tackle the problem. So I think events like this, where you get people to come into Madison and talk about it, that you can see action come as a result of it.
Now, you've seen a lot of collaboration bringing these town halls together, and that's actually one of the recommendations, that there needs to be more collaboration. Who needs to be collaborating on these issues, Jim?
It's a really broad range of people. It needs to happen better in the healthcare industry. We had a pediatrician in talking today about their offices are seeing a lot of issues with children's mental health things that pediatricians didn't get training for in medical school. I think that was really eye-opening, that there's such a severe shortage in the state that there are 16 counties that don't have an inpatient psychiatrist. So there's literally places that people have no access to care, and that's not always able to get access through things like telemedicine. So if you happen to be in one of those counties, it's very difficult to get care.
Chris, as you're out there telling your family story, are a lot of people approaching you and sharing theirs as well? Maybe something that they wouldn't have been willing to talk about unless they'd heard you go first?
Yes. I've definitely been approached by complete strangers or acquaintances or even friends of mine who have friends of their own with people in their family that are struggling. They want answers. They want a direction. They want to know, you know, types of things to look for and ways to help, because unfortunately the numbers of these kids that are in crisis is astronomical.
I imagine that, I mean, obviously a lot of teens dealing with depression, other mental health issues, feeling isolated, a lot of families feeling isolated. As we wrap up, I want to ask both of you, how important is it that people are out there talking about this? Chris, I'll start with you.
It's incredibly important. I hope that Morgan didn't keep this to herself and not come forward because she was embarrassed or anything else. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. This mental health is the same as physical health. So if a child has cancer, they get help for it. If they have diabetes, they get help for it. It's not their fault, and help, you know, we need to help them.
And Jim, what's the next step in advancing this conversation?
I think it's continuing to have discussions like this. One of the speakers we had today is a student at Kimberly High School who shared her experience with it, and she's sharing that with other students across the Fox Valley. So talking about it, getting people to connect, and doing that is so important.
Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Chris, thanks to you.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Jim Fitzhenry, editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin and the Kids in Crisis series. Chris Saha is also with us, former psychiatric nurse. She lost her teen daughter to suicide last year. They join us to talk about the Day of Action for Youth Mental Health. That was an event today hosted by USA Today Network Wisconsin.
Matthew Hefty grew up in Wisconsin, and after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, he signed up for military service. He served two deployments each in Iraq and Afghanistan as an explosive ordnance disposal technician. Now back in Wisconsin, he released his first novel earlier this year, drawing from his experiences in the military and his return to civilian life.
Matthew is now working with the Wisconsin Innocence Project, working toward a law degree. His new novel is called A Hard and Heavy Thing. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, your main character is a veteran from Wisconsin. At the outset of the novel, he's writing something. It's not clear. It could be a novel, a memoir, a letter to a friend, maybe even a suicide note. What's the story he's telling?
Essentially, he's telling the story of how he got to where he's at, which is a place of deep depression, and it's kind of a meditation on guilt in that he feels responsible for his best friend Nick's injuries, the loss of some of his teammates in Iraq, and he's come to this point where he is contemplating suicide.
And we hear often about the difficult transition back to civilian life, but something that struck me earlier on when your chapter titles is, let's be honest, we were broken before the war even started. So you don't really think about that so much. There were veterans were people before they went into service, before they went into wartime. How did all that blur together?
I think it was important to analyze why sometimes people join the military, because it's so easy to paint people into camps and cliches. You know, there's the prevailing narrative that some people joined because they were tricked. And then there's the other prevailing narrative that others joined because they just wanted to go get the bad guys. But often the reality of our lives is far more complex than that. And all of us, while sometimes fitting into cliches, also steadfastly resist them when we look at like the totality of our lives.
We Join in a Fit of Youth is the title of book one of your book.
Yes. The first book covers that period when they're joining the military. They're teenagers, they're playing in a punk rock band, perhaps drinking too much, and you know, they're filled with this restlessness. And when the 9/11 attacks occur, it serves for them as a catalyst to join the military, thinking that perhaps they can escape their small town, or perhaps they can go live lives of meaning, as opposed to kind of like the driftless world in which they're living.
And the driftless world, you're from Western Wisconsin. Do you see your upbringing in Western Wisconsin as any way a metaphor or informing the story you're telling?
I'm not sure about as a metaphor, but it's a place that I know, and it's a place that I love, so I wanted to set the characters there. It is my first book, so you write what you know. It's a little bit easier to do it that way. But I think the driftless world that I'm talking about is more the life of any teenager, where they're not really sure what it's all about.
Your book, as you mentioned, deals a lot with guilt, both from a wartime deployment and before. Why was guilt such an important part of the story you're telling here?
I think the guilt is an important part of the story because whereas the book is a meditation on guilt throughout, the real hero of the story at the end is the character Nick. And in that sense, the heroic act is grace, which is undeserved love by definition. And in order for grace to have its full effect, its full meaning, you have to also explore the converse side, which would be the guilt, you know, like exposing the person who's seeking grace in all their warts and all their problems, which is why Levi may come across as an unlikable character, because in order for him to receive that grace, if you will, from his friend Nick, that has to be undeserved. If he somehow earned it, then it wouldn't be worth what it's worth.
Can you talk about some of your experience during your deployments, dealing with unexploded ordnance? And this is obviously a big issue in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What was that like? This is an incredibly high-pressure situation.
Yes. Explosive ordnance disposal is an incredibly stressful career field. During my first deployment, we would have between 3 to 5 IEDs a day. Some days we would react with a quick reaction force, an infantry platoon, and go out to different forces that had come across IEDs on the side of the road or caches of weapons that they had found during raids. And every single response could lead to a completely different outcome. And you never really know what's lurking behind what you see, because there were so many booby traps and so many different tactics that those trying to plant the bombs would try to use to stay one step ahead of you.
Talking to Matthew Hefty, his new novel is A Hard and Heavy Thing, about a person returning from war, Iraq, Afghanistan. And Matthew, you went through this transition yourself. To some extent, was writing this novel part of how you made the transition from there to here?
Interestingly, not really. I wrote the complete novel and had finished before I had left the service. So in large parts, it was me looking forward to what will transition be like for me. And I had plenty of friends who were going through the transition process who were experiencing their own difficulties. And so I tried to step into their shoes and to, in a sense, step into my own in the future to see, okay, what pitfalls do I want to avoid? What things might be a problem? And in that way, kind of prepare myself in a way for transition as opposed to dealing with transition as it was happening.
In a lot of war writing, going back to the Odyssey, the characters faced with the fear that the world they left isn't going to be the same, that their place in it is gone. Is that something you dealt with in the book?
It's certainly something that's dealt with in the book. Levi returns, and he's not exactly sure what his place is anymore. When he was in the military, he was, you know, the squared away guy. He had won the Silver Star, and it seemed like he had everything going for him. Yet all that stuff wasn't enough, because it didn't fill that hole and it didn't alleviate that guilt that he carried around. And in that sense, certainly the world that he returned to was different because, you know, he felt alienated and that people could never understand what he had been through, even though right across the street is his best friend, Nick, who had gone through far worse than he had.
You're writing about guilt and forgiveness, and now you are a law student. You're working with the Wisconsin Innocence Project. Is there a connection here?
I think most definitely. I think that working for the Wisconsin Innocence Project has been far and away the most rewarding experience of my life, in that it allows us to help the least of these. The prisoners that we're helping are people oftentimes who are the least respected members of our society. We have them, you know, locked up in cages and never to be seen again. And in helping them, I can practice the kind of grace that I'm trying to preach. Certainly all the people that apply to the Wisconsin Innocence Project are not innocent, excuse me, but by actively trying to help them, actively showing that grace in that way, you know, we're really helping ourselves.
And as a law student, I understand one of your ultimate goals is to represent veterans in particular. Why is that a priority for you?
I think because it's a community that I'm now a part of, being a veteran. And I think it's a community that has special needs, in that a large part of our civilian society doesn't understand what veterans have gone through. That's not to say that we don't have large swaths of our society that need the same help, but being a veteran and having been in those shoes, it seems a natural fit to be able to step in and display empathy and help those people who need help.
You're also part of a community of writers with this experience as a veteran. You participate in a website for veteran writers. What do you learn writing and reading sort of collaboratively online remotely?
I think the most interesting part about that, and what keeps me drawn to it, is the free exchange of ideas, political ideas, religious ideas, ideas about war, what it means to exercise our power as Americans. And we don't always agree. In fact, sometimes we vehemently disagree. But the one thing that keeps us all together, writing together, is the fact that we all kind of fought for this freedom to express these ideas.
You mentioned the idea of the cliche of why people sign up, and I think there are a lot of things that are maybe cliches or generalizations, maybe even well-meaning, about veterans. Through your writing, through your work, are you hoping to say, well, yeah, there are things in common, but there's an individual story for everybody?
Yes. I think that in both respects, you're right in that some of these generalizations are well-meaning, and in fact, many of us do fall into one of these camps or the other. But that is usually a superficial thing on a summary level. And when you dig a little deeper, whereas you could probably put us each into a camp or a cliche, you can also differentiate each one of us because we are all unique and we all do have different stories.
Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Matthew Hefty. His new novel is called A Hard and Heavy Thing. With Ohio Governor John Kasich dropping out of the presidential race, Donald Trump is the final candidate standing for the Republican nomination. After a very heated primary in Wisconsin where the Republican Stop Trump movement really got some momentum, there's concern that Wisconsin Republicans will have trouble uniting around the presumptive nominee.
Joining us now to talk about the issue is Aaron Weinschenk, a political science professor at UW Green Bay. Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is about a month ago that the Republican Party leaders announced the 100 Days to Stop Trump movement, coinciding there with the Wisconsin primary. And today you've got one candidate left standing, Donald Trump. So how quickly and do you think Wisconsin voters are actually going to be able to make the switch from, it seems like a lot of them being part of this not Trump movement, supporting Cruz, to backing Donald Trump as the GOP nominee?
Yeah, I think it's gonna be difficult. You know, if you look at the results here, Cruz won by a fairly large chunk, and there are lots of parts of the state that are heavily Republican and conservative that really just don't seem to like Trump very much, and so it's going to be hard to persuade those people that, you know, he's the right person for the Republican Party. So I think it's hard to do.
Is it going to be kind of a staring contest here in Wisconsin with, you know, waiting to see if leadership here ends up backing Trump? You just heard in the news there, Paul Ryan saying, no, I'm not ready to do this. Scott Walker has sort of given what seemed like a sort of half-hearted endorsement of supporting Trump. So what are we waiting for here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're getting mixed views from party elites in the state. You know, Walker came out during the primary in support of Cruz, and now he said, you know, kind of unenthusiastically, I'll accept this. You see the RNC chair, Reince Priebus, saying we need to unite behind the candidate. But then I think there are others in the state who, again, are just totally against Trump as a Republican candidate. So you're getting kind of mixed signals from party leaders in the state about whether this is good or not.
And I don't want to read too much into how we perceive Governor Walker's level of enthusiasm. Let's hear it for ourselves. Here's what he said.
Sure.
I think Donald Trump is clearly better than Hillary Clinton for a variety of reasons.
So brief, to the point, is that much of an endorsement?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're hearing that kind of thing from a lot of the party leaders who said that they would eventually come to support, you know, the whoever the nominee might be. I think they were probably hoping it would be somebody else, so you can understand why they might not be enthusiastic. To me, that doesn't sound like, you know, like a glowing endorsement. It's like, this person is better than the other party's candidate, but you didn't really hear him go into the reasons, the attributes that he likes or the policy ideas that he likes very much. So to me, it's, you know, it's there, but it's not, you know, it's not a glowing endorsement.
Well, this news of as Donald Trump is a presumptive nominee, it's still very fresh. It just sort of coalesced, came together on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Do you think that people have had a chance to wrap their heads around it? Because starting out, people kind of thought that's never going to happen. It's very unlikely to happen, and it has happened. Has there been enough time to digest?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's still fresh in people's minds, and people are still, I think people thought that Cruz was going to stay in a lot longer, and, you know, you saw some of his attempts to try to collaborate with John Kasich and to try to shake up the race by picking Carly Fiorina before he was even the nominee. So I think, you know, people thought he might stick around a little bit longer. And I think, again, starting out, people thought that Trump is really not a serious candidate. He'll basically just fizzle out. And now we're to the point where of the 17 people who were in the race, some of whom had, you know, government experience and lots of name recognition, you get this unconventional candidate who's the one left standing.
You've got this tight Senate race this year as well between Senator Ron Johnson, former Senator Russ Feingold, and Johnson has said again that he will support Donald Trump, but he's more focused, it sounds like, on other things. The people of Wisconsin, I think, is a language that his campaign used. How do you think that's going to play out?
Yeah, I think that those lower level races where there's partisanship on the ballot should be a concern. You know, you've got a Republican presidential nominee or a presumptive nominee who's got pretty high unfavorability, is pretty unpopular. You know, the party was pretty divided on, or is pretty divided on him. And so, you know, if there is a potential for a connection between a candidate and somebody unpopular, you can imagine that their opponent is going to try to capitalize on that. And I think you have already seen Feingold, you know, trying to connect the two in some of the advertisements and social media. So I think it's already starting to happen.
We're talking with UW Green Bay's Aaron Weinschenk about whether or not the Wisconsin Republican Party can and will unite around the presumptive candidate nominee Donald Trump after a divisive primary season. And just in this last hour, again, we've seen that pre-recorded interview on CNN with Jake Trapper, Paul Ryan, saying he is not ready to support or endorse Donald Trump. Now, I'm not exactly sure how we're supposed to read that. It seems kind of unusual. I can think of a couple things. Maybe Paul Ryan is thinking, I just can't stomach this and I'm going to run after all. Maybe he's trying to bring Trump to heel a little bit by making him nervous and wanting the support. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, it's like, well, in order for, I eventually might, but he has to do a certain set of things in order for me to potentially come around. And in some of the articles that I was seeing today, you know, he said, Paul Ryan said, that there are some questions that conservative has. We really want to know if, you know, he's principled, if he's going to be consistent ideologically. You know, maybe if Trump does demonstrate those kinds of things, then you'll see some of these party leaders coming around.
How does he demonstrate that? What does he have to do?
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason why people who are really quite conservative don't really like Trump or don't see him as a true conservative is because just policy-wise, he tends to jump around quite a bit, hasn't demonstrated a lot of ideological consistency. Sometimes he says things that conservatives might really like. Sometimes he says things that liberals might really like these days. So I think the real hardcore conservatives out there want to see consistency. They want a conservative position on a whole bunch of different issues, and they're not seeing that, or they're not satisfied with what they're seeing so far.
Why do you think it is that the Wisconsin GOP seems to have trouble getting on board the so-called Trump train?
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe they're thinking about some of those down-ballot races, the Senate races and the House races that are going on, and they think there could be some negative effects there. You know, part of it could also be the kind of style of politics that he brings to the table. You know, we hear the phrase like Wisconsin nice, and, you know, Wisconsinites are known for being really polite. And, you know, I think Donald Trump has this really polarizing, unconventional style. He, you know, is not afraid to go after people, to offend entire groups of people. And so, you know, that kind of style that he has might not match with some of the people who live here, who are in politics here.
Do you have a sense about how big a deal Wisconsin could be in the general election?
I mean, I think if you look back to previous presidential elections, Wisconsin has been considered a battleground state for quite some time. You know, most of the election results here are reasonably close, although Democrats have won in the last 7 presidential elections. But, you know, I think parties see Wisconsin as a place that's up for grabs, that has a potential for them to persuade voters. So, you know, I think that Wisconsin has been a battleground, and, you know, it will get attention again in the future.
We've had pretty high turnout looking at the last election, at least. And do you think that it's possible that if the Wisconsin GOP is just not that into Donald Trump. They're going to stay home and maybe not go to the polls.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. Or, you know, there's other alternatives too. If you don't like the top of the ticket, you could show up. You don't have to vote for the presidential race. You could vote for some of the down ballot races. You could vote for another candidate that you decide to write in. So I think there are other alternatives out there, but it's interesting in the primaries and caucuses that have happened. They've been fairly high in some places, you know, higher than they've been in years in terms of turnout and participation. So there seems to be something going on that people are, you know, paying attention to what's going on, whether they like it or not. They're paying attention and seeing a lot of news coverage about it.
Well, here's a comment we got from Mark in Rice Lake. He says he thinks that the support will ultimately depend on who the vice presidential nominees or picks are. What do you think about that? How important is the VP?
I would say in presidential races, you know, vice presidential picks usually don't make or break the race. You know, for most people, the person whose name is at the top or, you know, who's the presidential nominee, that's the person they're making the decision about. So I don't know that I would pin an entire race on who the vice presidential pick will be. Maybe it could help with some of the things that people don't like about Trump. You know, he gets criticized for not having any previous experience and not a lot of policy expertise. So maybe you could pick somebody who has those kinds of skills. I think that, you know, in most cases, vice presidential picks tend to have, you know, short-term effects when they first happen. You know, maybe the person gets a bump in the polls, but usually things go back to normal, or in some cases, you know, get worse depending on who the person is. So usually I think they're sort of short-term strategic reasons, and then, people are ultimately deciding based on the person who's running for president.
We're talking to Aaron Weinschenk right now, political science professor for UW-Green Bay, talking about whether or not the Wisconsin Republican Party will unite around the presumptive nominee, Donald Trump.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a Republican, will you support Donald Trump as your candidate? If you're part of the Stop Trump effort, can you go Trump now? If you're a conservative, is Donald Trump conservative enough for you? What would he have to do to prove his bona fides? Do you want to see Trump as the candidate? Would you support him? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our discussion about whether or not the Wisconsin Republican Party will unite around the presumptive nominee Donald Trump after a divisive primary season. Our guest is Aaron Weinschenk, political science professor at UW-Green Bay.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Will Wisconsin Republicans back Donald Trump in the general election in November? Will you back him? Or are you looking for another option, even if you're a lifelong Republican? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Aaron, here's somebody who is not going to be backing Donald Trump, at least by the looks of it right now. Conservative talk show host Charlie Sykes, who just last night was on MSNBC, the Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. And here's what he said.
The fight over the nomination is over. Now we have the fight for the soul of the party. I mean, the reality is that, you know, Donald Trump is a serial liar. He's a race baiter. He's a xenophobe, somebody who mocks the disabled, who mocks women. And Republicans who roll over, who think this is business as usual, are going to own all of that. And I want them to think about this over the next 6 months, that every slur, every insult, every outrage, every lie, every wacky conspiracy theory, they're going to have to defend, they're going to have to rationalize, or they're going to have to evade.
Charlie Sykes there, he's not letting up at all. And is that going to matter in Wisconsin, Aaron, just super briefly so we can get to some calls?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, in the Wisconsin primary, there was a coordinated effort to, you know, to try to stop Trump. You saw party elites speaking out against him, people like Governor Walker endorsing Cruz and not supporting Trump. The conservative radio in Wisconsin was not on board with Trump. So, I mean, that to me, that signals something about, you know, him having an uphill battle come the general election here.
And we've got Ron on the line in Madison. Ron, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to add?
Well, I just have a comment about who I'm going to vote for. And I do want to comment on Sykes. Mm-hmm. I never thought I would agree with him, but I do 100%. I've been a Republican for more than 50 years. I have a degree in economics, a major in history. I've been studying all this stuff for more than 50 years. I will not vote for Trump. For decades, I've considered him super arrogant, self-serving and self-absorbed, and he's a bully. I'm not going to vote for him.
Will you vote for Clinton?
You know, if the race is really close, I would.
If the race is close, all right. Some strong words there from Ron. What's your response to that, Aaron, hearing something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are going to be people who rally behind Trump, who find some way of rationalizing him acceptable. But I think there is a subset of voters in Wisconsin and also across the United States that even if they are Republicans, really just cannot get behind them for some of the reasons that were just mentioned, and maybe for the ideological consistency or the fact that he doesn't have ideological inconsistency or the fact that he doesn't have experience in government. But I think there is a subset where it's impossible to persuade them.
Ron, thanks a lot for that. And our next call comes from Jerry in Waukesha. Jerry, hi.
Hi there.
What is your take?
I think I support Trump 110%. He's the clean bill of health that the government needs to get rid of all the people getting their billfolds padded by special interests and other organizations like that.
Jerry, thank you so much for calling. There you hear from Jerry, back-to-back with Ron. Jerry is in it with Donald Trump. He thinks this is sort of like a cleansing breath for the Republican Party, and he certainly represents another strand of thinking. As we wrap up, Aaron, what is your prediction, if any, here about how this is all going to shake out in Wisconsin?
This is a hard election to make predictions about because it's been so unpredictable. I would say just overall, I think that Clinton is advantaged right now. The GOP candidate has been pretty divisive. He's got really high unfavorable ratings. The economy is in reasonably good shape right now, at least on a lot of the objective measures. And those sorts of things bode well for Clinton. But, this is an unpredictable race, and there's still a lot of
Aaron, thanks
time.
So much. We leave it there. That was Aaron Weinschenk, political science professor from the UW Green Bay, talking about what might happen here in Wisconsin with the GOP and Donald Trump.